So about 3 years ago, I was using that sketchy white van that we pick up college students with because they have a low bar, a low standard. They're okay with eating pizza every day pretty much. And I was helping a friend move in Minneapolis, and then I was coming back to help a friend cat sit over in St. Paul, so I'm using this van to drive around. And two things to preface. One, I'm not a cat person, so don't get the wrong idea about me. And two, I'm not usually that generous with my time. I'm working on it, but yeah, that's just an issue. So I'm helping them with their cat, and I'm backing out of this skinny driveway with a 15-passenger van, and I hit something behind me. I get out real quick, and I notice that I hit the neighbor's fence, and half of me says, no big deal. I just kind of scraped some paint off of it. I'll take care of that later. And the other half of me says, I don't even want to know what else I did, so I'll deal with this later. And I just kind of wish that nobody had saw that, that I could cover it up, that I could just do that over, but I couldn't. And I think we don't have to hit a fence. We don't have to run into our neighbor's fence for this to come up in our everyday rhythms. It may look more natural if we just have a picture taken of us and we don't want it to be posted on social media. Or let's say we are talking kind of gossipy about somebody and then they or a friend walk in the room and we just kind of go on high alert and we hope that they didn't hear it. We wish we could just cover some stuff up that people don't really know about what we just did or said. Two ways that I just saw this come up in my life this last week, this idea of wanting to cover stuff up is I'm getting some knee rehab done. So when I went to my physical therapist this last Wednesday, I kind of had a script in my mind of I was going to give her a better version of how I've been doing with my rehab. She didn't even ask me how I was doing, and I still gave her the lie. Kind of just gave her a better picture of what I was actually doing. That's an issue. And the second way is I was in a conversation with a friend, and I noticed I was kind of wrong, but I still stuck firm to my argument. I don't know if you've done that before. And looking back, I noticed I just wasn't as open or teachable. And I essentially didn't want them to know I was wrong. I was covering something up there. So maybe you can relate with something of that, or just something comes to your mind about an experience or something in you that wants to cover stuff up and not be known in that way. And that's what David is getting at in this psalm. And he's actually talking about the key of confession being the key to the good life. So that's what we're going to unpack and read through today in Psalm 32. But before we get there, just please join in praying with me. Father, we come expectant to your word, and we open up your word in an everyday rhythm. We're here on Sunday morning. There's a confidence and an expectation that you can do something powerful by your spirit and your word and people gathering together. So why would this be any different? Move in your mighty way, even in these common, every week, everyday rhythms, Father, by your good name. Amen. So two ways that we're going to really focus on today are how confession is the key to the good life, primarily in that we get forgiveness from God and we get friendship with God. And we're going to start off in the first half of the psalm, which talks about forgiveness. So if you want to look at verses 1 and 2, it'll be up on the board, or you can open up a Bible in front of you. But verses 1 and 2 say, blessed is the one whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the one whose sin the Lord does not count against them, and in whose spirit is no deceit. You might have noticed that the word blessed came up twice there. Repetition is usually a key thing there. So the word blessed might be a little bit of a Christianese term, Christian rhetoric, but it actually has a ton of meaning. In that context, blessed meant good fortune. It meant the good life. It meant someone that had a well-being, a highly desired well-being. We see it a lot in advertisements. It's kind of the main message. They try to get you to believe that if you get a Gatorade when you leave here today, your life just got better. And it probably will have because of how hot it is. So it's not a lie. But they just kind of cast this image of if you have these things, you will look like these people on advertisements. That's the underlying theme that we see under advertisements. So that's what David's getting at is, you will be blessed if you have a clear conscience and you've been forgiven by God. That is the good life. That is the foundation to everything he's about to get into. And in verses 3 and 5, he shares his experience of how he got the good life. So if you look at verse 3, he says, when David kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night, your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. Amen to that. I think we can relate with that. If we're struggling and wanting to hide something up, we're thinking about it a ton. It's just kind of tiring and draining. There's this monologue or dialogue of us rerunning that or thinking how we're going to respond to someone. It leads just us being a little more less productive throughout our day. That's what David's experiencing right here. Essentially, what we're doing when we're being silent, when we're not telling the truth about certain things, is we're saying, I don't need Jesus. I've got this. That's what silence is expressing. Silence is the rejection of God's free gift of grace, and I think we're in good company because we all wrestle with that, but that's essentially what we're saying in that moment. But we can contrast it with what he says in verse 5, and this is where it gets to the good part. He says, then I, David, acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you, God, forgave the guilt of my sin. There's a key word right there, and it's the word confess. That word might have a little bit of baggage. When I first read it, I thought it did. It essentially means to tell the truth, though. So if we come from maybe more of a Catholic tradition or experience, the word confess might mean a very specific location or a very specific person, but the word confess essentially means to tell the truth. We do this all the time. If you're leaving an Amazon review, a Yelp review, if you're referring a mechanic or a plumber, you're confessing, you're telling the truth to something. It might be really positive, but it might also be negative. Where it gets a little bit more risky or uncomfortable, at least for me, is where I'm telling something about myself and it's not positive, it's negative. That's where I think David's relating right here, is he's confessing, telling a truth about himself, but it's actually a fault or wrongdoing that he's bringing forth into the light. What exactly is David confessing, though? In verse 5, we see three different words. He says, my sin, my iniquity, and my transgressions. No big deal. Those are big words. We're just going to quickly go through that. But essentially what he's saying is, I'm deeply flawed. There's some way that I ought to be that I'm not. He's sinning. He's sinned. But there's two other words that kind of define what that looks like. He says, he is flawed in terms of transgression, which means he's deliberately crossed the line in areas. And it also means iniquity, to go astray intentionally or unintentionally. So here David's actually urging us to confess the truth fully. The ways that we've knowingly and intentionally disobeyed God, but also the ways that we've unintentionally done that, or to just be open to the faults that we're not aware that we have done. And when we tell the truth about those things, he goes right to it in verse 5 and says, and God forgave the guilt of my sin. And he doesn't try to make it seem too easy, but he's essentially saying, God's already done this. He's just waiting for you to bring it out. He already knows about it. This is as simple as that. It's not easy. It was very costly for him, but for us, it's just saying we need him. And I experienced that when I backed into that guy's fence, because after 24 hours of just the same thing, just kind of convincing myself it's not a big deal, I finally went and looked on the other side of the fence, and I didn't just rub off some paint. I busted out a board that was sticking out on the other end. So that's where I knew I had to do something about it. So I practiced what I was going to tell this person. I was going to go over to the neighbor, and I finally walk up the courage, and I feel like I'm taking the walk of shame as I walk up to this person's door, ring the doorbell, and think, maybe they're just not going to come. I hope so. Well, that didn't happen. An older woman came to the door. I told her really briefly, hey, I kind of backed into your fence, and she goes, I'm gonna go get my husband. Thanks, okay, I don't know what that means. And this stone-faced guy walks up to the door. He's got his veteran's hat on. I've unfortunately taken a step into their house because she welcomed me in. I'm gonna regret that in about 5 seconds. And just kind of cut to the chase, and I go, sir, I actually backed into your fence yesterday. I scraped off some paint. Do you know what color that is? I'll go buy paint. I'll take care of it. I broke a board. I don't know how I'm going to fix that, but I'll try, or I'll pay for it. And he's just kind of standing there. And there's that moment where I'm just like, how is he going to respond? And he goes, I know. I saw it. I've been waiting for you to come over here. And if you see those, if you've ever watched a horror film, Some of them start the movie by saying, based on a true story. For a flash, I'm like, this is me. No one's ever going to see me again. They should make a movie about it. Fortunately, he followed it up by saying, don't even worry about the fence. I've got someone coming next week to take care of it. And my awkwardness kind of turned to a peace and confusion, where I quickly realized it was like, so you don't even want me to pay for the paint? You're just kind of, someone's going to put their time to that, and you're going to pay them to do that. And I didn't have, it was taken care of. And that's exactly what David experiences here in verse 5. He's like, I was honest, I told the truth, and God took care of it. It was as simple as that. Maybe not as easy as that, but as simple as that. It's not that easy for us, though, because as we notice these patterns in our life of not telling the truth, it's not so simple. It took me 24 hours just to tell a dude I backed into his fence. In fact, that was a good week. Probably would have taken a week if I was cat-sitting longer. Why is it so difficult for us? Well, Tim Keller briefly references this in his book, The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness. So I'm going to quickly cover a couple of these. It's not all-encompassing. But one way it might be difficult for us to tell the truth is if we're prone to pride. Those of us that resonate with that, whether all the time or in a certain week, the test can be is if we respond to criticism by commonly ignoring it, we may be prone to pride. Our focus is on performance, particularly our accomplishments and our self-image. We're more so blind to our faults, or we just simply have the gift of seeing them and kind of covering them up and moving on a little quicker. Confession feels like falling off the pedestal that we have put ourselves onto. So it seems maybe a little less necessary, or at least it's really uncomfortable because then we know we have to reconsider a lot about ourselves. The issue with it is when we place a focus on how we view ourselves, it assumes that we're aware of all of our faults, where if we have even one honest friend or roommate or spouse, we know that that's not the truth, that we don't know all of our deep issues. Another way that we could be prone to not telling the truth is if we're prone to shame. And the test, if that's us that week or more generally, is if someone approaches us with criticism and our response is we're kind of devastated by it. It really bugs us. Even if that person's handled that well and approached us well, it really bugs us. In shame, our performance is maintaining a reputation of who others say we should be. It's based on their opinion, according to Keller. We tend to cover up these areas like David did in verses 3 and 4. Maybe it's our coworkers' expectation or our parents' standards. We just can't hit it. So we try to cover it up based on a fear of that meaning something deep about our identity. A common solution from counselors to a low self-esteem based on other people's standards for ourselves is actually to flip it and set a standard for ourselves to boost our self-esteem. The issue with that is eventually it falls short and that we realize we've really just cut a corner, we've really just lowered the bar, or it can swing to the other pendulum and then we just become prideful. Maybe you resonate with one of those two now or in general. A third is actually if we have a more relativistic perspective, is the third and final one. That means our view is more so that all people are good people, unless you're maybe the person that really got busted and did something bad and you're on TV. Morality is more culturally selected. And we can at least solve this tension of not being who we know we could be by not submitting to religion, getting to set a moral code. And for any of us that resonate with that in this room or anyone that knows someone like that, we love that those people come into this community. And we actually appreciate the honesty when they just say, I don't know why I'm here, or I'm asking questions, or I'm just observing today. And you may be thinking, maybe not, but your perspective may be, which we appreciate, that God's really just trying to set up a self-dependent code for us to be reliant on him, or religious leaders for us to be reliant on them. Or maybe it's that shame and fear tactic. But I would suggest that that's not what's going on here in Psalm 32. Or in the Christian faith, but it's actually a different definition of humility. And C.S. Lewis defines humility really simply by saying, humility in the Christian life is not thinking less of ourselves, but thinking about ourselves less. So it's humility is not thinking less of who we are, but thinking about ourselves less often. And that is a trajectory towards the good life that David is talking about in Psalm 32. The good life is actually living based upon how God views us, not others or ourselves. And the test to that, if we're there at least more often, is when we get criticized, we view it as a growth opportunity. We don't recoil, but we don't get as defensive. Happiness or the good life is found in how God views us, which is based in Jesus' performance and not our performance. And I think that's actually what everyone's looking for, because it's based and allows us to be truly known and fully loved at the same time. And we can only get that in Jesus Christ. And we see this exact posture, if you want someone that imitates it, in the Apostle Paul. He calls himself the chief or the worst sinner. And even though he says that about his past life of seeking power and approval on his own code, he's not crushed by it. He says, people don't set the standard for who I am. I don't even set the standard for who I am. God sets that, and it's based on Jesus' perfect, his sacrificial, and his powerful life. We see that flowing into maybe a next step of what does that mean in our life? And it essentially means the next step is confessing that we're deeply flawed and not just knowing we need to be forgiven, but actually experiencing that we are forgiven by Jesus, as David did when he went from silence and covering it up to bringing it into the light and knowing God had already taken care of it at that point. I've had a friend that said when he's in conflict or criticism, the first thing he does is he grabs a pad of paper and a pen, and he goes to a coffee shop. And he said he just writes down all the things that he needs to take responsibility for in these situations. He's essentially saying, what do I need to confess? What do I need to bring forward here? And I love his heart and his posture. And if we need another example of what that's looked like, there's a woman in this congregation that 2 years ago stood up where I was, and Rachel Soto, who's in the back, shared about her past struggle with alcohol. And if you're anything like me, you didn't envy her circumstances in that moment, but you envied something that she had in her. There was such a strength and a beauty to that. There's such a confidence and a humility. She was living in the good life by just admitting that she's deeply flawed, but simultaneously experiencing the grace of Jesus in that scenario. And I'm not sure where you're at, but I know that that's a pretty risky proposition. Because what if this Jesus thing doesn't work out for me? Or what if this leads to a pretty weird relationship if someone doesn't reciprocate that? Or what if it's just a little easier to stay in more superficial relationships and not share that stuff? I get that. What if you knew how much I complained and grumbled and how much I don't want people to know about that? Maybe I'm a party pooper. Maybe I'm not as fun to be with. It's not fun to talk about. I don't want that to be my reputation. The cool thing is that God promises us it's worth it in that risk and uncomfortability. He promises us, this is a promise from our faithful Lord, he promises us forgiveness. And if forgiveness is good, his friendship is even better. And that's what the whole second half of the psalm is about. Confession is the key to the good life. We are forgiven by God, but we also are offered friendship with God. So let's turn to Psalm 32, 6 through 8, along with verse 10. It says, therefore, let all the faithful pray to you, God, while you may be found. Surely the rising of the mighty waters will not reach them. You, God, are my hiding place. You will protect me from trouble and surround me with songs of deliverance. David's confidence is in God, not himself. I will instruct you, says God, and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you with my loving eye on you. My caring watch will be over you. Verse 10, many are the woes of the wicked, but the Lord's unfailing love surrounds the one who trusts in him. The good news is that friendship from God means he wants to instruct us. He wants to guide us. He wants to mentor us. He offers us an unfailing, unbending, unconditional love. Again, we notice his confidence is in him, God, and not in his own performance. And that's what I experienced again when I hit this dude's fence, because he didn't just take care of the payment there. He continued to catch me off guard. where after that, he then said, do you want to just have a beer and sit in my porch with me? And I'm just like, okay, this is where he's going to like poison it. This is where he really, this is the plot twist in the movie. And no, I sit on his porch with him. We spend over an hour together. And his wife is bringing me lemonade and a beer. And I'm just like, this is crazy. That's what God does for us. He doesn't just forgive us, even though we need that. But then he welcomes us into a relationship. It seems too good to be true. And that's what this guy did. He embodied our Heavenly Father to each one of you and to us when we live in telling the truth. God, in verse 9, understands that even though we're offered that loving relationship, sometimes we tend to needing to be brought back in different ways. So in verse 9, he says, do not be like the horse or the mule, which having no understanding, but must be controlled by bit and bridle, or they will not come to you. So bit and bridle, essentially a horse or a mule, they'll put this rope, and it'll be connected to a metal piece that they jam into the back of their mouth. And that metal piece is, I don't know horses, so if I'm off, we can talk later. But this metal piece is used to pull back into their back of their throat when they want to be stopped or when they need to be turned, because horses are just going to do their own thing. Same with a mule. So in these scenarios, God's saying, don't be like that. Don't put me in the scenario where I constantly need to be putting consequences or pain in your life for you to listen to me or to get my attention. I want you to be in a friendship with me where you obey, where you confess, because you know that I love you and that's going to keep coming. You trust that my way is better. Don't be like the horse that needs consequences, that needs pain, that needs these things that are based on self-interest to re-get our attention. He'll put that in our life. In fact, in John 15, we see that God says, I will prune you. I will put certain things in your life, not because you're drifting, but simply because I want you to become more who I've made you to be. But in Psalm 32, we see David mentioning how God's going to put certain consequences in our life because he loves us so much. He doesn't want us to drift so far away. God has offered us a friendship that looks almost uncanny to us because even his discipline and his mentorship and his constant love is offered when we're simply honest and we tell the truth. And for those of us that are not Christians, we may think that's too simple. And I get it. Or for those of us that are Christians, we know that when we leave here today, we're going to be prone to revert back to patterns of pride and patterns of shame, to covering stuff up or ignoring it. And Paul knew that that was going to be the struggle of people, and he addressed that in Romans 4. As we end here, I want to bring our eyes here. Romans 4, verse 3, Paul's writing this to the church in Rome. What does Scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Now to the one who works, wages are not credited as a gift, but as an obligation. However, to the one who does not work, but trusts God who justifies the ungodly, their faith is credited as righteousness. David says the same thing in Psalm 32 when he speaks of the blessedness of the good life to the one whom God credits the righteousness apart from their works. So he's quoting Psalm 32, 1 and 2. Blessed are those whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. The good life is the one whose sin the Lord will never count against them. We see the same pattern as David ends Psalm 32, verse 11. He says, rejoice in the Lord and be glad, you righteous. Sing, all you who are upright in heart. He repeats that word righteous. And the first time I read through it, I keep thinking righteous means that they've done a good enough job. They've actually accomplished the stuff. But he's not talking about that. He's actually saying the upright in heart and the righteous are not the people that did a good enough job or were good enough people. They were the people that confessed, that lived the truth. They dragged it into the light and said, I'm deeply flawed. And they've experienced the grace of Jesus, the forgiveness and the friendship. That's the righteous. That's the upright in heart that Paul addresses there, that we know that we're going to be prone to revert back to, or I know I will, 5 minutes from now. I'm prone to perform up here even. Tim Keller has a quote that summarizes those last two verses well, where he says, cheer up. We are more sinful and flawed in ourselves than we ever dared believe. Yet at the very same time, we are more loved and accepted in Jesus Christ than we ever dared hope. And that's what this whole psalm is getting at. We are far more flawed and sinful than we ever dared imagine or believe. But Jesus' forgiveness means we can be honest about our deep flaws and experience the process of God putting it back together and how he's already taken care of that. There's no legitimate reason we need to keep performing and living in these swinging patterns of pride and shame. But at the very same time, we are far more loved than we ever could dream up or imagine. And Jesus' friendship means we can obey, we can trust, we can confess, knowing that his love is a lot better than obeying and confessing out of our own self-interest, about needing consequences, needing pain. But our motivation for being his friend and loving him and obeying and confessing is we know the costly love of Jesus, what he accomplished on the cross in our place. We know that it grieves our Father when we sin. It's okay to say it's not okay. It's just not okay to stay there. That's our motivating factor. The costly love of Christ on the cross. Now we know it grieves him, not a confession because we don't want to get caught or the consequences. That's the key to the good life that David points us to even before he knew Jesus. Confession is the key to the good life, forgiveness from God, and friendship with God.